This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. This is Sterling Allen, your host. You can join us each day at freeenergynews.com. And our radio website is freeenergynow.net. We have as our guest today Jim Dunn, who is the Chief Technology Officer for the Center for Technology Commercialization. Jim Dunn, welcome for joining us.
Thank you, Sterling. I'm glad to be with you today.
You're in Denver today.
I am. I'm out for the Green Build Conference here, and also I had a very exciting meeting up at the Rocky Mountain Institute in Snowmass on Tuesday. So we're enjoying the beautiful weather out here, although it was a little snowy and icy earlier in the week.
I actually hearken from Boulder, Colorado. I was born and raised there.
Beautiful, God's country out here, beautiful country.
Yeah, it is. I'm on the other side of the divide today. That's where I live, in Eagle Mountain, but I'm at my sister's home. It's an $8 million home. It's an open house, and so I found a quiet little corner here. Amazing home, tell you that.
Sounds like it. Wow. I hope it's all zero energy and off the grid.
Nope. She wanted to, but her husband wasn't too much into that, so that didn't happen.
Well, I'm sure that you'll have another chance to help them out in the future when gas and electric prices get up so high that they're paying more for utilities than they are for their mortgage.
Yeah, that's not too far away. But, you know, there are so many technologies that can move us away from coal and oil and gas and all that. That's what we're going to be talking about here today. You're tied into all kinds of projects and interests and pursuits. This is not going to be the first time we have you on. We could go on for hours and hours and hours today, and then there's always new things coming on, and you're always right on the cutting edge, paying attention to stuff, and I learn all kinds of things from you. So I think it's a rub each other back type of situation where I think you probably glean some stuff from us once in a while, and I'm always gleaning stuff from you. So nice to have you on today.
Great. Well, I hope we can have some fun and enlighten the listeners to some of the exciting things that are happening in our world of both energy and how we deal with the global warming challenges.
Yeah, let's just, what is your take on the whole peak oil, global warming, just briefly?
Well, it's kind of interesting. 2 weeks ago, I attended the peak oil conference, the World Conference in Boston, and I had no idea how many people were tracking the petroleum situation and dealing with looking at all our fossil fuels. And one thing is clear, that whether we peaked last December, which is what a lot of people say, or whether we're peaking this year or next year, in any event, we got a real crisis on our hands. And when you think that we have about 2 trillion, or had about 2 trillion barrels of oil in the world, and about another trillion to two of unconventional oil or resources that could yield oil, shale oil and the tar sands and stuff. The fact that we, over the last 100 to 120 years, used up the first trillion barrels, and at the rate we're running at right now, which is about 84 million barrels a day, it's forecast that we are probably likely to deplete the last trillion or the second trillion sometime in the next 30 to 40 years, and then work really, really hard at the unconventional oil sources, maybe for another 20 to 25 years, and then we're at the point where we don't get enough back for the energy invested to make it worthwhile, even though, and by then we'll probably have gasoline to be about $75 to $100 a gallon, so we won't have that many people wanting to use it. And the thing that came out of the conference that I thought was most interesting was that we really have to start thinking about making a transition for transportation as far as wheeled transportation, you know, cars, trucks, buses, and so on, soon, because We still have to have liquid fuels for aviation and a lot of military applications, and of course for all of the other things that we get from petroleum, nylons and rugs and all the other specialty materials that are derived from petroleum.
You know, I heard a saying one time that burning an oil for heat is like burning a Picasso for heat.
Well, it may come to that point. I think that's still a few years away. The funny thing is, though, that even though the conference in Boston was primarily focused on peak oil and the American Association of Peak Oil, actually the first night was all about global warming and what we can do to start dealing with both CO2 and other harmful gases in the greenhouse gas arena, including methane. And it looked like that problem was actually more pressing in terms of having a limited amount of time to work with it than the peak oil. And most of the people there were saying that we have maybe between 10 and 25 years before we hit the tipping point, the point which there's nothing we can do to further, mitigate the damage. And once the, Greenland and all these other icebergs have melted, and of course then, we've lost Manhattan. We lost the most of Cape Cod and a lot of the Atlantic seashore and all the famous beaches, and we've lost a third of Florida. We won't be able to make a refrigerator big enough to freeze back down and get the sea level reduced.
Well, part of it, too, isn't it, that you get into a negative feedback loop situation where the rate of heating and the release of methane and other gases from, like, the permafrost up in the north, that it actually starts this negative feedback loop to a point that we, no matter what we do, we can't turn it around.
That's right. And they were saying that the methyl hydrates, which are fairly delicate in the temperature shift of the ocean water, once they start releasing and release all that methane into the atmosphere, combined with all of the trapped vegetation that's been, for hundreds or millions of years in under the permafrost. And when that releases, and they're saying that methane is about 20 times as bad as carbon dioxide. So it was a pretty scary conference. And I came out of there thinking, oh, my gosh, everyone's worried about what do we do when we run out of oil. But we have far worse problems that are going to hit us much sooner than that. And they were pointing out that where we're at 380 parts per million of CO2 now, which is the highest point in 30 million years, that doing everything possible and everything they could think of in terms of ways to mitigate and sequester carbon dioxide, we might be able to start to flatten the curve at 440 parts per million. But at that point, it looks like we'll already have a 3 to 5 meter increase in sea height. But almost everyone there, all the world's leading experts, Matt Simmons, who wrote Twilight in the Desert, and one of the most knowledgeable people on oil, they were all saying that they thought we were headed towards 550 parts per million, which would be a correction of somewhere in the area of more like 10 meters or more of ocean height increase. So anyone who's living near the beach, or if you want a beachfront property and you're a few blocks back in, just wait about 10 or 15 years and you may have a beachfront property. You might have some unsightly buildings that are washed out in front of you, but that was very, very scary. And the other thing that was interesting about the conference was that a lot of the different forecasters and people that were assessing the different impacts of, for instance, China and India and a lot of the Asian countries, where now all of a sudden their needs for oil are growing at such a phenomenal rate that within about 15 years, they're going to overtake the U.S., both as the major consumers of petroleum, but also as some of the major polluters. You've spoken yourself, Sterling, many times of the fact that, unfortunately, in America, we have a little less than 5% of the world's population, but we use 25% of the world's energy and create 30% of the world's pollution. And this is really sad that the average American really isn't sensitive to this. And I don't think there are that many people that are really aware of how quickly this is coming on us, and that we really have to start taking immediate action right now.
You were talking earlier about how the President of the United States is aware of these things and is somewhat has his hands tied because of the lobbying interest in the funding that he and others in his coterie have received from the oil interests.
Yeah, that's a difficult situation. Matt Simmons was a personal advisor to Dick Cheney and the President, and has briefed them a lot on both the peak oil situation and some of the countries that have already peaked. Of course, the U.S. peaked back around 1970, and we're now peaking both Canada and Mexico's oil, and actually we are peaking in the compressed natural gas area right as we speak, and we are also peaking Mexico and Canada's natural gas as well. We have less than 2% of the world's natural gas reserves, and even though we have a lot of natural gas that's, you know, discovered and available out there, we don't have a way to capture it. We don't have it near pipelines, so we call it stranded natural gas. And even in Alaska, you know, a lot of the natural gas that's there that is really, discovered typically on top of oil finds and different petroleum deposits. Unfortunately, if you don't have a way to, trap it and, deliver it somehow or use it on site or liquefy it. Right now, the U.S. has only four liquefaction terminals or four terminals that can accept liquid natural gas. And on the East Coast, we take a lot in from Trinidad. And that's expensive when you have to liquefy natural gas, which takes 30 to 40% of the energy to liquefy it, and then deliver it by a tanker, and then pipe that somewhere inland and store it in terminals, and then convert it back into gaseous natural gas. So, or use it sometimes as propane. We got a lot of people that are, and more of our power plants, by the way, over 200 of the last power plants built run solely on natural gas, and a lot of those plants were built mainly as peaking plants, just to provide peak energy, particularly during the hot summer months when everyone's running their air conditioner. And now we're running those in some cases 15, 16 hours a day. On top of that, we have a lot of fossil fuel plants that people thought were going to be phased out, a lot of coal-fired plants that we've had to bring those back online. As a matter of fact, President Bush has been looking at plans and has discussed having 200 additional nuclear power plants on top of the 103 that we have running. Actually, I think there's 102 of the 103 running today. So to add 200 more nuclear power plants just to keep up with electric demands is really pretty scary when we really could be doing a lot more in the renewable area, and that's what frustrates me. With all the things that are happening in wind energy and the low-cost wind turbines today, and all the things that are happening in solar, although solar is still somewhat expensive, we still only generate 1% of our total power from renewable sources, including hydropower. It's appalling. If you were to think of taking the $400 billion that we've expended over in Iraq trying to secure future sources of oil and had applied those just to wind turbines, and let's say we just use the land that can't be farmed in North and South Dakota, and to put wind turbines up in that area, we already would be free and independent of any foreign oil imports.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding.
Say that one more time.
If we had used the $400 billion and invested that just in putting up wind turbines on the land in North and South Dakota that cannot be farmed, we would already be independent of foreign oil as far as a lot of the needs and dependencies, particularly we still have to make some adjustments from the standpoint of liquid fuels that we use in transportation.
Mm-hmm.
But as you know, the electric car is...
Now, that's an energy production because that would require the installation of additional grid lines and whatnot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it would. I mean, it wouldn't all go into wind turbines. We would still then have to build some grid delivery infrastructure to be able to get that power, to the point. Obviously, North Dakota and South Dakota aren't places that have a lot of, civilization or plants where they need a lot of power. We would need to build grids to take it to the West Coast, like San Francisco, L.A., Seattle, and so on, and maybe east to Chicago and places like that. But ultimately, with superconducting wire and other things that we have available, You know, that certainly is all going to be possible. The biggest thing, though, I think, is going to be the transition of our transportation infrastructure, which uses about 60% of all of our imported oil. And I think that people are seeing now, General Motors just announced they're going to bring out an electric car, believe it or not, maybe because of all the people complaining about killing the EV1 in the movie Who Killed the Electric Car, but they're going to show a very interesting electric car that's pretty much a series hybrid. They're going to show at the January FAE conference.
It's a pleasure.
Hopefully that will be a car that won't just be a show car or a concept car, but they'll actually put it in production.
Mm-hmm. And that would actually be generating electricity to run, in other words, a motor rather than running a drivetrain would run a generator to keep the batteries topped.
Well, the way they're looking at, you know, the typical hybrid, particularly the Prius Synergy Drive, uses both a electric drivetrain and the gasoline engine and resolves the power or matches it up and integrates it in a planetary transmission, a continuously variable planetary transmission. And so that's really a parallel power source because both power sources then are tied into the drive shaft out to the wheels. In the vehicle design that General Motors announced, they would actually have a battery-dominant power source so that the only way that you're propelled is with electric motors, you know, turning the wheels. And then to augment the electric energy that will be stored in batteries, much more battery capacity than you have in any of the Honda or Toyota hybrids, you would then have a small either gasoline or diesel engine that would run and be coupled directly to a generator. So it wouldn't be quite as efficient overall because when you're running the gasoline engine and you're using that to generate auxiliary electricity to then, while you're stopped, recharge the batteries or while you're underway, provide the power that then, you know, drives the electric motors, you still have a little bit more losses because you have the efficiency loss of the generator coupled with the fact that, you know, gasoline engines are not all that efficient, typically in the 20 to 24% area, where electric motors are very close to 90% efficient. And some of the motors and drivetrains together are, you know, with all the losses, are still better than 80, 85%. Whereas in a gasoline engine, you know, the engine may be 22% efficient, let's say. I think the very best Miller and Atkinson cycle engines maybe in the 24% area. Diesel engines are in the low 30s, but then you've got the losses in the transmission and then some losses, you know, going out delivering power to the wheels, which aren't that great. But at the end of the day, your amount of energy, if you take it right from the well to the wheels, which a lot of people call well-to-wheels efficiency, you may be looking typically in a car today somewhere in the 15% area, well-to-wheels. From the oil well, you know, out to the wheels. So we're trying to change all that, and I think we're going to have to look to a lot of new fuel sources and a gradual transition over to electric, which is where we started with back in the early 1900s. The Baker electric car, the Detroit electric car, the Milburn, which is a very exciting electric car that was made all the way up to the mid-20s. And, you know, there were a number of electric car companies that actually made a go at it, but unfortunately the cars, you know, were limited by the amount of energy stored in the batteries. And back in those days, by the way, there were lead-acid batteries, but the predominant battery was a nickel-iron battery. And ironically enough, today, with all the money we've spent and all the years of research and billions of dollars of money that the U.S. government has put in with the Advanced Battery Consortium and other programs of DOE, we still haven't reached the point where we have a good, reliable battery with sufficient energy density to really compete with gasoline.
Well, you're talking about the EE Store battery. What's the deal with that?
Well, EE Store is an ultracapacitor that uses barium titanate as a base material. And the interesting thing is most ultracapacitors today are in the range of 2.5 to 3 volts per cell. And just like lithium ion or other batteries, you have to string a lot of those cells in series to get up to the 300 to 500 volt range that most of our electric drivetrains operate at. This new energy storage device as a capacitor can operate with voltages up to 3,500 volts per cell. And the energy that you store is actually goes up with the square of the voltage. So if we increase the voltage 1,000-fold from 3 volts to 3,000, the amount of energy stored would actually be 1,000 squared, or 1,000,000 times as much. So if they can really pull this off and make a capacitor that will work at such high voltages, that will be a major breakthrough. And they've already forecast that they can build an energy storage system that will store 52 kilowatt hours of energy, in which if you think of a car that would be like the Prius, normally operates at about 200 to 250 watt hours per mile. So 1 kilowatt hour would run the car for somewhere in the area of 4 to 5 miles. And now if you have 52 kilowatt hours times 5, you got like 260 miles of range. And they estimate that they can make that battery pack such that it would weigh 336 pounds, which is lighter than you would need in any battery form to get that kind of range. Even the most advanced lithium-ion batteries would weigh far more than that for that range. Like the Tesla and other cars you've heard about, they're looking at, somewhere between 700 and 900 pounds of batteries. And they're talking about a cost of between $2,000 and $3,000 for this energy storage system that would have a virtual, almost infinite life that would be good for millions of charge-discharge cycles and would have such a low internal impedance and such a low loss that you could charge it up in 5 to 10 minutes. Now, that's sort of the holy grail, particularly when you look at the cost that they're talking about. Whether they can pull this off or not remains to be seen, but within the next 6 months, we should see whether or not they're able to achieve these very aggressive goals. And if they are, and that becomes a predominant energy source, it's very easy to build an electric car. As a matter of fact, all the fuel cell powered cars that you see coming out of Detroit and Japan, in fact, every major automaker has, one or two different fuel cell powered cars that they're out showcasing, and few of them are making, numbers anywhere from 10 to 100 of them. Like the General Motors, I think they're going to build it in an Equinox coming up this spring. A bunch of them, Daimler has about 60 fuel cell cars out there. Well, if you took the fuel cell part out, the rest of it is basically an electric car. And that drivetrain is all that you need, whatever source of energy you put in there to produce the electricity. And if this is only $2,000 versus $50,000 to $100,000 for the fuel cells that we're looking at today, it's going to be a lot more affordable and probably last a lot longer and have a lot easier fueling applications versus building an infrastructure for delivering hydrogen all across America, which has been estimated to cost several hundred million dollars, assuming we can get to the point where we can make that transition.
Right. Before we jump over to the subject of hydrogen, just one question on you were talking earlier today when we were chatting about this 5 to 10 minute storage or fill time on these capacitors would require 1,000,000 watts.
Well, if you think about this, if you're going to store 50 kilowatt hours of energy, let's assume that you're totally depleted and you need to do a full charge, and they're going to do that in 5 minutes. Let's just say 6 minutes. 6 minutes is a tenth of an hour, right? So if you work out the math, that would require a minimum of 500,000 watts of energy, okay, to fill that in a tenth of an hour. To fill it faster is going to require even more. Normally, you have a safety factor on your power feed so that you're not sitting there heating up all the wires. But you would generally need something close to a megawatt entrance or megawatt power. Now, if you were looking at your average home and you have 220 volts, and some of the bigger homes today have a 200-amp entrance, most homes have a 100-amp entrance, let's just take the 200-amp entrance times 220 volts, that's 44 kilowatts, a far cry from the 500 kilowatts that you would need. Or to do it on a large scale, like at a gas station, if you're filling 10 or 20 of these cars, recharging them, you know, all at the same time. Now you need something that looks like a small power substation, you know, something in the area of 10 to 25 megawatts. So that's going to be a little bit of a challenge. If you're charging your vehicle at home, you'd probably be charging it overnight, maybe with an automatic charger that is going to use off-peak power, and probably at 1 o'clock in the morning, unless your wife's running the clothes dryer and doing some early morning cooking, you're probably not taking a lot of extra power. So if you charged it at home and it took you, you know, 6 or 7 hours, that wouldn't be a problem. You could do that adequately off your home power. And actually, you're doing the utilities a favor if you're using that off-peak power, because normally that's when power is very cheap. You know, you get down to 2 to 3 cents a kilowatt hour in the East Coast between midnight and 6 a.m., and particularly with the hydropower from Hydro-Quebec and other, you know, sources like that, even some of the nuclear power plants, because, you know, you can't really just shut off a nuclear power plant. So they like to be able to load those, you know, level off the loading and be able to, you know, have customers continue to draw power all night long. That's why we make aluminum at night. All our aluminum plants in the east are all along the Canadian border, a lot of them in Messina, New York, with Alcoa and Reynolds and Alcan, the Canadian aluminum companies. And they take advantage of that cheap power because aluminum is so energy intensive in order to produce it. And we also have other, you know, operations, like if you're making silicon, another crisis that we're up against right now, that's very energy intensive as well. So the idea, though, with the electric car is that we might have even another interesting opportunity. Now let's assume that we can make a low-cost way to store power. And we have a lot of cars, and particularly those where you can design this in without losing a lot of space, because the gravimetric density, you know, may be comparable to gasoline, but the volumetric density may be an issue. It may actually take more volume to build a 50-kilowatt-hour energy storage system. But let's assume now we have a lot of cars that have that ability to store that much energy, and you're driving your car into work, and you get to work, and you plug all your cars in, not to a charger, but basically to tap into all that energy that you stored overnight. Now you actually have a vehicle-to-grid capacity, and the ability to fill in a lot of situations where you have peak demands, and, you know, with air conditioning and other loads around the East Coast here, and particularly, you know, New York City and Washington and other cities, they have a lot of deals that the utilities have cut with customers where they can shut off certain levels of load at certain times so they can deal with the demand. Usually, you know, mid to late afternoon is when they're peaking. And so if you're, let's assume that you're a customer that signed up with that, they shut off your home water heater, let's say, for an hour. Now, do you think anyone's going to suffer as a result of having your water heater off for an hour when no one's home? So, I mean, a lot of interesting things that they have to do today. But now think about getting 10 to 20 times as much available power to augment their peak needs. And this would dramatically reduce the impact of brownouts that you hear about and probably would totally eliminate any blackouts of power. So there's a lot of interesting things that we can possibly look forward to in the transition, which is long overdue, to electrified transportation.
Yeah, let's talk back. Let's get back to hydrogen now.
Okay. Well, hydrogen, unfortunately, you know, although the president has led everyone to believe that it's just around the corner and it's an easy transition, unfortunately, hydrogen is really an energy carrier. Hydrogen is not a fuel source that we can naturally find, although hydrogen as element number one is the most common and lightest element, you know, in the world. In order to get it, we have to extract it either from hydrocarbons, like compressed natural gas, where 96% of all our hydrogen comes from today by steam reforming natural gas, or from water. Unfortunately, to extract hydrogen from water, we typically today use electrolysis. But electrolysis is not only a costly process, it takes about 60 to 70 kilowatt hours of energy to make 1 kilogram of hydrogen, splitting it from water. Now, in addition, the cost of the equipment, in terms of the electrolyzer, particularly if we use the membrane-based electrolyzer, because a lot of electrolyzers are just fuel cells run backwards, like a proton, you know, a PEM, a proton electrolyte membrane fuel cell, or, you know, we also have alkaline-based fuel cells. But the cost of hydrogen right now is so high that Ford, who just started producing hydrogen combustion cars, you think of hydrogen being used two ways, either in a fuel cell where we catalytically react it in combining it with oxygen and produce water as a byproduct. When we burn it, we also go through somewhat of a similar process. In the combustion process, we also only produce water as a byproduct. So we don't have any emissions, which is great. However, you have to be able to get hydrogen, and you have to be able to afford it. And right now, Ford is running into a real problem because they have this E450 shuttle van, which is a beautiful vehicle. They modified the Triton V10 engine to burn hydrogen, and they've come up with an amazing engine that is incredibly efficient. Actually, it's running about 30% thermal efficiency, even higher than any comparable, even the same engine running on gasoline. They don't get quite the same amount of power out of it. They need an intercooler, and they had to modify the engine somewhat. But they have an engine that's relatively low cost to produce, and that when it combusts hydrogen, you know, has no emissions of any kind. And it's, you know, certainly a good start in that direction, but they're spending between $16 and $25 a kilogram for the hydrogen to fuel this. A kilogram of hydrogen, remember, is equivalent energy to a gallon of gas. So if we're going to make this work, and I applaud the president for his great hopes to make it look like this is going to be the coming wave, but we don't have any way today to produce hydrogen at a competitive cost. And then once you've produced hydrogen, then you have to compress it to be able to store it or liquefy it, which takes even more energy than compressing it. And then if you liquefy it, you have to keep it cryo-cooled at minus 253 degrees, which is not easy to do. And you have another problem that when you go to dispense the hydrogen, you know, that requires a fair amount of care. And if you're storing it at a gas station and they have, you know, a large amount of storage, you know, between times when they're going to get refueled, as they're, you know, dispensing it, their pressure is dropping down, okay, from the pressure it was delivered at. So they need a compressor as well. So they need to actually add even more energy, you know, to actually, you know, put it into a tank, because your tanks in your car, most of the ones today, are running between 5 and 10,000 PSI. So obviously the gas station that's going to refill you has to have equal or higher pressure. So it's not a simple solution, and you know, it really, when you think about it, unless we can figure out a way to make hydrogen from water and sunlight, which is the areas that I'm working on right now, and we have some hopeful emerging technologies, but to make it from compressed natural gas like we're doing today is just making a bad situation worse. Because as you saw last year with Katrina, the cost of natural gas, which had been running somewhere between $8 and $10 a thousand cubic feet, or a million BTUs, you know, either way, went up to between $15 and $19. And that rippled through, you know, everyone, whether you're burning it at home and cooking and heating with natural gas, or whether you're using it even in natural gas fueled vehicles. So we have... You have a little bit of a dilemma here, that we still need to have liquid fuels, ultimately for particularly aircraft. You know, I'm the only person in the world that has a fuel cell powered electric airplane, and airplanes, you know, are not, you know, as easy to operate on electricity. Although, if it's propeller driven, it's a little bit simpler. But we've got a lot of ground to cover in a very short period of time to really make this transition and introduce a lot of new technologies to the world.
Well, you're a fuel cell man. Isn't that your primary expertise?
Well, fuel cells, certainly, particularly proton exchange membrane fuel cells, are one of my strong suits and an area that I spend a lot of time consulting in and working on, as well as the whole hydrogen arena. I mean, I think we can break the code on hydrogen, and I'm very hopeful that we'll be able to use some of these new technologies that are emerging where we just use sunlight and water as our primary ingredients. And there's one that's been developed actually down in Florida at the Florida Hydrogen Center, which is interesting, but it works at a fairly high temperature. There's one that's been developed by a company, NanoSolar, up in Massachusetts that's exciting, that uses nanostructured titania. But the one that I'm most excited about was developed by Reaction Sciences down in New Jersey. And this uses vanadium trichloride and waste heat. And the vanadium trichloride is like a co-catalyst that's used in the process, but you get it all back again at the end. And this is very, very clever. And so just using water and waste heat from a nuclear reactor instead of the cooling tower or from a refinery or from any, you know, steel process. I mean, there's a lot of places where you have waste heat, sort of medium grade in the 400 to 500 degrees C area. If for some reason you didn't have waste heat, you could do that with a thermal trough. Just a basic parabolic reflector reflecting sunlight onto a heat receiver in which you put an oil or helium or hydrogen or some transfer fluid to move the heat from the collector, you know, over to the operation where you were processing the vanadium trichloride. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of hope and a lot of things, and that, by the way, would produce hydrogen at well under $1 a kilogram, even if you have to amortize the solar troughs. But there would be no hydrocarbons used, no fuel used at all, just water, and it's a very efficient process. So these are the kind of things that I'm excited about for the future. But in order to then use that hydrogen, we still have to get the cost of fuel cells down, including the cost of the noble metals, typically platinum, that are used in the fuel cell. And the cost of platinum, you know, has been over $1,000 an ounce now for several years. And this is going to only get higher as we use more and more of it, besides catalytic converters and other uses for platinum. If we start using it a lot in fuel cells, at a cost of, you know, over several $1,000 of platinum per vehicle, per fuel cell, all of a sudden, you know, we're going to, you know, have an even increased, you know, supply costs or commodity costs. But the real hope is that we can do things possibly with new technologies like free piston engines. And I don't know if you've seen the work done at Sandia Laboratories with DOE. Some of the scientists there have developed an engine that actually has one moving part, a piston, that goes back and forth inside a cylinder that fires at either end. And they have actually tested this on hydrogen and modeled numbers up to 50% thermal efficiency, which is about as good as we do with fuel cells, which is the whole excitement of the fuel cell besides the emissions issue, which was the high efficiency. Mm-hmm. And this is an engine that inside the piston is full of magnets. And the magnets, when the piston goes back and forth, are inside a coil that's wrapped around the outside of the cylinder. And basically, you've got a very simple linear generator. And as this goes back and forth, each time it's producing power. And that power now can be used either to power a vehicle or power your home or virtually any application where you need power on demand. And you've got an engine that's so simple it would cost probably less than $700 to produce it, maybe a little bit more for the electronic controls, and something that would last more than 1 million miles. Mm-hmm. Now imagine that you put one of these in the back of a car that otherwise might have an electric drivetrain. Could have been an electric car, a hybrid car, a plug-in hybrid, or a fuel cell-powered car that you just use this as the primary power source. And maybe you add a little ultra-tap, boost power for taking off and climbing hills and things. Now, to me, you have the holy grail. I mean, you now have a way to use a fuel source that, such as hydrogen, that burns with no emissions. And when you get home at night, these are, by the way, producing 30 to 35 kilowatts of power, which is more than enough for virtually any passenger vehicle and enough for a lot of trucks. You can then plug your whole neighborhood in and run 8 to 10 homes off the output of the free piston generator, you know, while you're not using your car. So I think we have a lot of exciting things that are emerging. How we make the transition and keep Detroit in the game, I think, is the big challenge for the U.S. because if you've read the book, The End of Detroit, where it's forecast that by 2010, Toyota takes over as the world's leader, and General Motors and Ford are on the edge of bankruptcy, well, all the things that this woman who wrote this book forecasts are happening, but about 2 years earlier. Mm-hmm. And it's scary when you think of the fact that if they don't start making some dramatic changes quickly in Detroit, there may not be enough customers left wanting to buy sport utility vehicles when gasoline gets to $10 a gallon, which isn't far off. And we may have, by then, you know, Toyota has announced that every car they make, when they redesign it, you know, every 5 or 6 years, they do a total makeover. As they do that, they're going to add the hybrid option to cars so that by 2010, every vehicle they offer will have a hybrid option. And some of them will have plug-in hybrids starting in 2008, where they'll have a longer pure electric driving range. So a lot of the things that are coming, unfortunately, are not good for Detroit unless Detroit can really, really start, and they know what to do. I mean, the amount of money that has been spent developing hybrid vehicles like 10, 15 years ago under the USABC's program, the Partnership for the New Generation of Vehicles, the Freedom Car Program. I mean, we've had a number of different programs that all of the big three have, you know, developed cars. Most of these cars, by the way, were in the 80-mile-per-gallon area. But then they got put back in the warehouse or in the lab somewhere, and none of these things hit the street.
80 miles per gallon, when was that?
That was back in the, I want to say early to mid-90s, more than 10 years ago. All three of the car companies demonstrated. I went to some of the events where they showcased these cars. Now, they used, you know, a lot of composite materials. Some of the hybrids, these are all hybrid vehicles, but some of them were diesel hybrids. Some of them were gasoline hybrids. They had very advanced powertrains. And they had all the things that are now coming out of Japan. We had actually, in the U.S., led the world in hybrid technology in the late 80s and early 90s. And although you hear of Andy Frank, you know, being the father of the plug-in hybrid out of UC Davis, we actually had a lot of similar things, going on and being demonstrated in Detroit in these test programs. So now I hope that we can dust these things off and bring them back out of the labs and get them into production in time to save Detroit. And as you know, I have a weekly talk show, This New Car, on WICN in Worcester, Massachusetts, which is a FM jazz radio station, and we're on every Sunday night from 9:30 to 10:30. That's probably the most common question and the most common theme that comes up with people is how is the U.S. going to be able to make this transition when Toyota, for instance, is clearly way ahead in the hybrid vehicle arena. Although Honda is also in the game, they're quite a ways behind. But Nissan and all the other Japanese companies are all getting ready to introduce some pretty exciting hybrids over the next 2 years. Detroit has, as you know, the Ford Escape Hybrid, which is a very nice car, by the way, and has a lot of similar features to the Toyota design with a continuously variable transmission and a lot of similar controls and other, you know, functions. They also have that in the Mariner, but they're not making many of these, and it's really unfortunate. We have some mild hybrids that have come out with the Saturn View. General Motors brought out the Silverado idle stop hybrid, which basically just shut the engine down when you came to a stoplight, which really doesn't help you a lot if you're out on the highway. And unless you're in the city, it doesn't have any benefit. And we have the Tahoe hybrid coming, which is using a very interesting dual-motor transmission that was developed by Allison. So we have some things coming, and actually doing the sport utility vehicles and heavier vehicles really makes a lot of sense. But, you know, can they make these adjustments in time and really begin to get the penetration to catch up with Toyota already has over 500,000 hybrids on the highway. And they're now building the new plant, the new Camry plant, just started producing hybrids here in the U.S. I'm currently driving a Camry hybrid myself, my fifth hybrid. I have a Honda Insight that I bought when they first came out in 2000. And that's a great little car, but it's only a two-passenger car, and it's a little bit limited on the, high speed, and the power isn't really quite as much as you might want for driving along on superhighways. Then I had three Priuses, and I'm just now, really getting to see the fine engineering that Toyota has done in the Camry, because this hybrid has a really strong electric drivetrain, 105 kilowatts, where the Prius is much smaller, around 33. And this has a lot more powerful gasoline engine with a 16-valve, four-cylinder, Atkinson cycle engine that is incredibly efficient. And I can be cruising along with four people in the car at 75 miles an hour, and I'm still getting more than 40 miles to the gallon. In fact, this car will easily do 100 to 120 if people really need to drive on the Autobahn or places where, unfortunately they are driving faster than they probably should be. But the Priuses and the Civic hybrids and others are really not good in terms of really high-speed driving. Not that we should be wasting gas at high speeds, but there really is a tremendous amount of improvement that's happened in the hybrids just in the short time that Toyota's been making them, and quite a lot of learning that Detroit has to do to catch up.
Let's talk about silicone for a second.
Okay, well, when we talk about renewables, the whole photovoltaic world is just about to go through a major, major, major explosion. As you know, the U.S. back in the 80s and up through the mid-90s, we were the world leader in photovoltaic panels. And actually, in 1997, U.S. solar manufacturers captured 100% of the domestic market. And by 2003, that was down to only 73%. And now we're at a point where, ironically enough, we need to really try and regain our leadership, because most of the photovoltaic panels made in the U.S. now are actually being shipped over to Germany. Germany has 57% of the world's market in photovoltaics. But we're now at a point, even though it's still very, very small out of the total world power, but we're up at a point of over 1,000 megawatts of power generation that is being shipped each year from plants all over the world. But the world's leading plants are now plants like Sharp, which has about 27% of the world market, Kyocera, Sanyo, Mitsubishi, even Honda is jumping into the game. And we have BP Solar, actually, which has a nice plant down in Frederick, Maryland. Is one of the larger U.S. plays. We have Evergreen Solar and a number of others that have jumped in. But we've got a really weird thing that's happened. Over the last 2 years, the growth of the silicon photovoltaic panels, which actually 94% of the photovoltaic market still is based on silicon, and that's dropping gradually because we have other new technologies emerging. But the normal price for solar-grade silicon, which is typically thought of as 5/9 purity, versus semiconductor-grade, which is 8/9 to 9/9 purity, we normally used to use the waste silicon from the semiconductor industry to make photovoltaic panels. But now it's grown so rapidly that we're having to use a lot of the purer semiconductor-grade silicon. And the spot market prices actually have jumped up to almost $200, and in some places in the world, over $200 a kilogram, where typically they were running between $30 and $50 a kilogram. So we've now depleted all of the world supply, and they're actually using up a lot of the semiconductor-grade silicon as well. And by the way, the total world production is only about 35 to 40,000 tons a year. And this really, is inhibiting the growth of the photovoltaic panel industry. So we're now just about to come out with some mind-boggling new ways to make solar-grade silicon. Silicon that will only be pure enough for use in photovoltaic panels. You won't be able to use it for the traditional semiconductor market. And most of that silicon is normally made in plants that use the Siemens process. And those plants typically cost between $350 and $500 million for a plant that will produce between 3,000 and 5,000 tons a year. And although we have companies like Hemlock and others that are rapidly expanding and building new plants, we've got to get down to a point where we can be making 100,000 tons or more a year, which is what the Chinese want to do, because they're planning to enter this business in such a big way that we can really drive down the cost per watt so that ultimately solar panels will be competitive with other power sources. Right now, on a cost per watt basis, if you buy a wind turbine, you know, you're looking at between 75 cents and a dollar a watt for, you know, a new wind turbine going in. And then depending on what you're doing and the size of it as far as controls and things, you may add some additional costs. But photovoltaic panels, although they were coming down a nice learning curve till we hit this shortage of silicon, they're still in the area of $5 to $7 a watt installed. So they're about, you know, six times the cost for a given configuration. Now, the nice thing is that once you've put up, a photovoltaic system, and most of the ones that you see, you know, traditionally we see are maybe between 5 and 10,000 watts on homes. And in Germany, of course, they're subsidizing the cost so that it doesn't really cost so much. If you've got a south-facing roof, the government will put a photovoltaic array up for you and then buy back the power at a premium. So they actually, that's why the industry is growing so rapidly. In California and other states, even New Jersey here in the East Coast, they subsidize 70% of the cost of photovoltaic panels. And, of course, California has the $3 billion program that started with the Million Roof plans. And Schwarzenegger has done an awful lot there to help move that along. But when you reach a point where even though our domestic photovoltaic plants and all the Japanese plants can't make enough product, Evergreen Solar, they have orders, over $700 million of orders, but they can't begin to build the plants to process those orders because they can't get enough silicon. And a lot of other plants, they're sold out 5 to 7 years in advance. So the Chinese plan to enter this business in a tremendously big way, and so does Taiwan and Thailand and all of Asia, is going to jump into producing photovoltaic panels. And within 5 years, I think the cost will be down to about $1.50 a watt, which is then, at that point, going to be competitive to the point where you won't need a rebate or an incentive or some government, a tax deduction, whatever, to justify, putting solar on your home. And we'll see actually complete power plants out in the deserts. And, you look down in Arizona, New Mexico, California, Texas, there's lots of areas where there's just wide, wide open land that would be ideal to harvest solar in. And look at all the roofs. Look at Google recently and Walmart and all the companies that are now taking their roofs, particularly in California, and covering them with solar panels and producing million-watt-plus insulation, some of them going up to 5 megawatts. So we're going to see such a tremendous, tremendous growth in solar that I'm hoping that within, within 10 years, certainly and maybe sooner, we'll have 5 to 10% of all of our domestic power being generated with photovoltaics. And also all the emerging technologies that are coming along and things like the new SIGS process that Honda and others are working on, the cadmium indium diselenide, and using materials that, getting away from silicon, and also the thin film photovoltaics where they only use a very small amount of silicon, per watt. Getting down in some cases to below a gram per watt of silicon. And then also concentrating systems where you have lenses and mirrors and things that focus up to 1,000 times as much sunlight onto a smaller photovoltaic panel. So So we have a lot of things that are happening, and I think that this whole industry is just going to take off to the point where if we can become a little bit more green-focused, and at the same time, people are starting to really get on to conservation efforts, ways to reduce their power consumption.
Right.
You know, compact fluorescent lights. I mean, there's so many things that can be done at almost no cost. You drive through downtown cities now where, you know, 5-10 years ago, you used to see all the lights on in all the office buildings at night. Now you only see a third of them on all night long. So we're getting there.
At the end of the hour, I want to, before we close out, where can people go to listen to your Sunday show? Is there a website?
We will be putting up a website shortly, but for now, I'm just trying to think.
I created a profile page for you today at PES Wiki.
Oh, okay, yeah. If you've got that, what I'll do is I'll put links into all the recordings. We're going to try and set up something for podcasting, and we actually took all of last year's shows and put those out on a CD. But the station is WICN.com. which is 90.5 FM, and we're on the East Coast from 9:30 to 10:30 every Sunday night, which will be tonight. People actually, if they want to learn more about it, it's kind of funny. I don't know if the station is going to, provide as much as we'll probably link in if you have something set up on Free Energy News that we can, put a link to for now. That'd be great.
Yeah, we've got one at CS Weekly. Well, thanks, Jim, for joining us. We didn't get to Cold Fusion. We'll have to bring that up in another session.
Yeah, we'll bring that up another time because that's still a couple years further out.
Yeah. Well, it's been a great session. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you very much. Bye now.
Bye.